Maybe you've heard of the Warren Court or the Roberts Court as ways of identifying the U.S. Supreme Court by its Chief Justice. Well, what about the Kilbride Court? That's how you'd identify the Illinois Supreme Court by its Chief Justice, Thomas Kilbride. The Illinois Supreme Court convenes in Chicago this week, and the cases they'll hear this fall will result in rulings that affect areas from state pensions to the liability faced by taverns when someone they serve causes an accident. I'm Jim Meadows, and we'll be talking with attorneys Steve Beckett and Kirk Jenkins about the Illinois Supreme Court today on Focus on WILL. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The U.S. Supreme Court won't convene until next month, but the Illinois Supreme Court is scheduled to convene today at its temporary home on the 18th floor of the Michael Bolandic Building in downtown Chicago, and that's a building named after a former Illinois Chief Justice. The court is convening in Chicago while the Supreme Court building in Springfield is renovated. Throughout the fall term, the High Court will be hearing 17 civil and criminal cases, if I'm counting correctly, some of which could affect you directly. My guests today on Focus are two attorneys who have both argued cases before the Illinois Supreme Court. Kirk Jenkins is an appellate attorney in Chicago. He's a partner at Sedgwick Law. He blogs for The Appellate Strategist. Steve Beckett is a founder and counselor with the Urbana law firm Beckett & Weber and is a lecturer in law at the University of Illinois College of Law, and he's also a former member of the Champaign County Board. Kirk, Steve, I want to welcome both of you to Focus today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
And don't know where we want to start as far as who talks first here, but what is it like arguing a case before the Illinois Supreme Court? I've seen movies made about the U.S. Supreme Court suggesting that there's a certain amount of ceremony and gravitas and just something special and different. But maybe I should let me start with you, Steve. Are there specific, I don't know, customs, procedures, and atmosphere that stick in your memory from the times you've argued before the Illinois Supreme Court sets it apart from a lower court?
Not really. There's a greater degree of informality in the Illinois Supreme Court than certainly the U.S. Supreme Court. There's a lawyer's lounge at the back of the chambers, and you sort of sit in the lawyer's lounge and you prepare, and then you walk in and you sit in the gallery. And then when your case is called, you walk up to counsel table and you begin. In U.S. Supreme Court, they have these rows of tables for the cases that are scheduled for the docket that morning, and you're supposed to be there. And you sit at the tables in the well of the courtroom, and as the cases advance, then you move up. First time I was there, fortunately, we were the first case. Second time, we were the second case, and so we had to go through that. And when the justices come out in the U.S. Supreme Court, it's really quite formal with spreading curtains. Obviously a certain formality with the Illinois Supreme Court coming out to assume the bench. There are seven of them, so that makes it much different than an appellate court where there are only three.
Kirk, are there any things that you noticed in the times you've argued before the court?
The courtroom in Springfield is a beautiful and imposing venue, so that always makes it a special occasion to go down there. But to me, I've been in front of the Supreme Courts of several different states around the country, and what really impresses me every time I go down there is the atmosphere among the justices themselves is different than it is in a number of states. It's a very hot bench, and they seem to be actively looking for the engaging with the case and looking for the best answer. There's not a lot of gamesmanship that's evident in their questioning between one justice and another like you get in some states, and particularly in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, interesting, you used the phrase hot bench. Steve also used it when we were talking off the air before the program. Although I gather from you, Steve, because you've argued before the court over the years, that the bench is hotter now than it used to be.
Yes.
And by hot bench, we should explain.
Justices are asking questions. This is not some formal rhetorical exercise where you are summarizing your case and making salient constitutional or statutory points. These are judges who are asking you questions about the impact of the positions that you're taking, or perhaps a clarification of some important fact.
We're going to get into some of the cases a little later on in the show that the Illinois Supreme Court will be hearing this term. If you have some questions about the Illinois Supreme Court, give us a call. The phone number is toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Or you can email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And besides phone or email, you can send them to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Kirk, does the Illinois Supreme Court wear robes?
Absolutely.
So they certainly have that sort of formality. Do all state Supreme Courts do that in your experience of the different ones you've been to?
In my experience, at every level, courts wear robes. The only type of tribunal where you don't see it is state administrative boards.
One thing I was realizing as I was reading up more about the Illinois Supreme Court is that they're elected. The U.S. Supreme Court, of course, is not elected, but the Illinois Supreme Court is. And it's strange. I don't have strong memories of voting for the Illinois Supreme Court in previous elections, but it is an elected office. In your view, Steve, if I could ask you, do you think having an elected court versus an appointed court at this level, does it change the makeup of the court?
I think it does. There are some cases that you see where it becomes sort of predictable that the Republican justices have a point of view or a perspective that is different than the Democratic justices. You see that sometimes in criminal cases. There was a huge controversy about Justice Carmeier and his election in relation to what we call tort reform. There's certainly politics, I think, involved in that as well.
And in Justice Carmeier, that was the winner in a Supreme Court election, which is reputed to have been the most expensive in terms of campaign spending.
That's correct. With a pending case involving a huge judgment against State Farm Insurance Company that ultimately he sat on and voted with the majority to reverse that judgment.
Kirk, is that what you see with an elected Supreme Court? Are the partisan lines pretty obvious?
Well, it's a very controversial issue in the appellate bar right now. There are some very powerful voices that are out there arguing that making judges electable is never a good idea, and it raises all kinds of issues when judges have to run for office, particularly in states like Illinois, where they run as a member of a particular political party. The appellate judges that I've known over the years, I think unanimously would prefer that they not be known to the public as personalities at all, that the public's view of them be no further than a good, hardworking judge who writes strong opinions trying to apply the law, because they don't want their personality out front, because it gives the idea that the court is governed by personalities as opposed to governed by what they believe the law should be.
I agree with that completely. I'm a member of a special committee of the State Bar Association that reviews complaints about judicial campaign advertising and comments, and it's truly unfortunate the way judicial campaigns have evolved.
Do you think if judges were appointed, perhaps along the lines of the federal system, say appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of a legislative body, would it be a lower profile, or would it be as high a profile and political as the appointment of U.S. Supreme Court justices are?
Well, I don't think you're going to get politics out of it, regardless of whether we go to a merit selection system where the governor picks judges and justices off of merit lists, and then some, you know, the Senate or in some other way the legislative branch can, you know, confirms them. Because of the nature of the beast, the political beast, there's going to be politics there. I think the idea is judges will not have to campaign. They won't have to look for money. I think that's where the source of evil is thought to be.
Thomas Kilbride is the Chief Justice of Illinois. And is it correct to say the Chief Justice of Illinois or the Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court?
Illinois Supreme Court, Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court.
So it's not the same as saying like the Chief Justice of the United States.
No. He's Chief Justice for a term. Typically, I think it's like 4 years. So his term is up, and we just, of course, heard last week that based on seniority, that the likely new Chief Justice will be Rita Garman from Danville.
And for those of you keeping score, the Illinois Supreme Court justices are elected from appellate districts, 3 from the district in Cook County and 1 from each of the other districts. So if you live in Danville or in that area, this is the justice that you elected, Justice Garman. What impact does the Chief Justice have on the court overall? Is that a powerful position?
Well, the Chief Justice, if in the majority, has the power to assign an opinion. If the Chief Justice is in the minority, then the justice has the senior justice in the majority has the power. I really think that other than that, I'm not sure that there is any great power by being Chief Justice. I think there are lots of ceremonial duties that go along with it.
Kirk, is that what you see? There's not much. But if I say the Kilbride Court, it's not like I'm really seeing the mark of Justice Kilbride on the court overall.
Well, actually, I've seen a little bit of an evolving picture in the court over the last 10 years as the Chief Justices have. Come and gone. The differences are subtle, but you do see a little bit of a difference in the voting patterns from one Chief Justice to the next. Chief Justice Kilbride's court, particularly in the last couple of months of 2010 and throughout 2011, had an unusually high level of unanimity in civil cases. But to me, the primary challenge that faces the Chief Justice and the primary challenge that will face a Chief Justice Garman is the administrative work. Chief Justice Kilbride has been a superb representative of the court, wrote a powerful piece for the Bar Association several months ago about the impact of lack of funding on the Illinois judiciary. He's pushed forward the idea of e-filing, which could potentially save the state an enormous amount of money. He's started pilot programs for cameras in the courts. And, of course, all of this is done in tandem with the rest of the court. But these are all things that happened on his watch. So I'll be interested to see the way the administrative side moves forward under a Chief Justice Garman.
Okay, so then this is some of the things the watching out for just the organizational health of the court system that may not get the public's attention, but is important for. Important for the running and the maintenance of the not just the Supreme Court but the entire state court system.
That's correct, and the Chief Justice is the primary voice in lobbying the legislature, lobbying the government for the level of funding that he or she feels is needed for the judiciary to deliver the services that it's supposed to deliver. That's what motivated Chief Justice Kilbride to write his piece several months ago.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about the Illinois Supreme Court with attorneys Kirk Jenkins in Chicago and Steve Beckett here in Urbana. And if you have questions about the state's highest court, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Steve, I'm wondering the type of cases that end up in the lap of the Illinois Supreme Court. We know the U.S. Supreme Court hears cases that may have come through federal court, or they may have been appealed from a state court to the U.S. Supreme Court. Are there sort of what sort of cases are the cases where the Illinois Supreme Court is really going to have the last say?
Well, the Illinois Supreme Court controls its own docket in the sense that since we don't have the death penalty anymore, there are no cases that I'm aware of that are appeals of right. Perhaps Kirk can correct me on that, but I'm not aware of any. And so their docket is controlled because people have to seek leave to appeal. The court is not required to take that. They can take a pass on a case right now thinking that an issue isn't ripe. But in general, they're responsible for the overall court system. So an important issue like pensions, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, later, that they may take action on that in a way that's almost unprecedented. Otherwise, they'll be looking for conflicts in appellate districts or within decisions within the same district to try to resolve issues of law so that we can have a form of uniformity throughout the state and guidance for all of our lower courts. We have, I was thinking there as Kirk was talking, that under Kilbride, we also have the Illinois Rules of Evidence, which we've never had, which I think is a yeoman's effort to try to bring some sense to the potpourri that has been Illinois evidence law for a couple hundred years. And that's certainly the fact that the Kilbride Court did that is certainly important. And now there'll be decisions under the Illinois Rules of Evidence to try to make some sense out of some of the crazy things that we have.
You know, that might be worth jumping to a case here I have on a list that's on the docket that seems to involve evidence, and that might be something you know something about, Steve. The People versus Keith Pikes, is that one of those evidence cases?
Yes, it is. It's a murder case out of Chicago, out of Cook County, and in the case, the defendant had sought to bar introduction into evidence of what we call other act or other crime evidence. There was a shooting where one gang was shooting at another gang, and the defendant, Pikes, was not involved in that shooting at all. His lawyers sought to keep out this shooting incident from his trial, and the trial court overruled his objections and let this other crime evidence in. The appellate court held that under 404B, which is this rule, that other act evidence was not permissible. The Supreme Court has granted review in that case. I think it will be really interesting to see how they interpret the rules of evidence.
So this is sort of like a test of these new rules of evidence.
Well, the question is they've been very slow in discussing these new rules in their opinions because they only took effect a year ago, I think it was January 1, 2011. And so this case was probably tried at or near that time of the original trial where the defendant was convicted, but they've been very slow to address them. I think it's sort of evolving.
It's sort of a shakeup period, and I guess that could be years, actually, for rules of evidence. Kirk, I'm wondering if you've seen as far as the Kilbride rules are concerned, has everything been working okay? Is it pretty much of a common sense sort of thing that is laid out here, or are there some things that just have to be taken up a case at a time in cases like this?
I think Steve's right that the cases arising on the civil side out of the rules of evidence are percolating up relatively slowly. They've had relatively little make it to the Supreme Court on the civil side that are evidentiary questions. Most of the stuff on the civil side last year was that falls under the general category of civil procedure was questions of creating new causes of action, new claims for suit.
In this case, as we look at a case and wonder what its impact could be, as soon as you say, well, this happened in a gang-related crime, people will say, you know, like, well, unless I'm a victim, that's not going to have any effect on me. But could a ruling like this affect other sorts of legal cases far away from gang violence?
Well, the other act aspect of it is the element that I think could have effect, you know, statewide. There already is a substantial body of law about gang-related evidence. It's the other act issue that I think may have some impact.
So that could bring it up in other types of cases. Maybe a corporate case.
These are only criminal.
Okay.
These are only going to be criminal cases, and I think Kirk would probably agree that oftentimes there's a clear demarcation on the criminal docket and on the civil docket, and it's often never the twain shall meet.
Well, let's go over to a case which is on the civil side and which a lot of people are thinking about because that's the case involving the state employee pensions. And if I understand this is right, Canerva versus Weems?
Yes, that's correct.
And Kirk, could you tell us a little bit about this case?
This case arose from something called the State Employee Group Insurance Act. And basically what the act says is that a government official, he's the director of the Department of Central Management Services, has the job of allocating the cost of health insurance premiums between state and the retired public employees, as in this is what the state is going to contribute, this is what the employee, the retiree, is responsible for. And long story short, after several different amendments over the years, in 1997, they had provided for a graduated premium payment based on years of service, but at the 20-year mark, if you've been with the state for more than 20 years, the idea was that the state would pay for 100% of the health insurance going forward. Well, now in 2012, there's been an amendment to the statute to allow the director to change that. And there are a number of claims that are in Canerva, but really the centerpiece of the case is the notion that this change in the free health benefits is a violation of the Illinois Pension Protection Clause, which basically says that a public pension in Illinois is an enforceable contract, and the benefits can't be diminished or impaired.
And so the question is this payment towards, say, as a state employee, my health insurance rather than directly to me as a pension, is that also my pension or is it something else?
That's exactly the question. And the issue that it turned on at the lower court, and Canerva is a little unusual in that it came straight up from the circuit courts, the trial courts. It was never in the appellate court.
And who decided that it would skip the appellate court?
The Supreme Court granted a motion to take it straight up because they regarded it as such an important issue that it was something that they should address immediately. But the issue that you point to is exactly what the case turned on at the trial court. The trial court said a pension is set when you retire. It's based on actuarial principles. You're however years old, you were here for X long, your pension is going to be this many dollars. Health insurance is entirely different. It's based on cost, technology, how well someone does in negotiating with a company, any number of things, and it changes from one year to the next. So at least in the trial court's view, that was a fundamental disconnect that meant these health benefits couldn't be considered a pension.
And is there any precedent to go on as to how this ruling might come out, or do both sides have something to argue with here?
Well, both sides have something to argue with, but I think it's fairly clear that the case will be overshadowed by the case that's coming down the road in a year or two, because the court will approach Kanerva knowing full well, since they're going to have to speak on the pension protection clause, that whatever they say is going to be put under a microscope in the political branches. And if they were to take a hardline view, certainly a hardline view about the breadth of the pension protection clause, but arguably a hardline view in the other direction too, that it could throw a substantial wrench into what's going on in the legislature. And in my experience, appellate judges tend to get very nervous when they feel like suddenly they're going to be heavily involved in ongoing political issues.
So do you think some appellate justices were breathing a sigh of relief when they saw this case skipping ahead to the Illinois Supreme Court?
I would not be surprised if the appellate court was not upset that the Supreme Court decided to take Kanerva directly.
And so this sounds like a case, and maybe, Steve, you could comment here. Is this a case where politics plays a role in what the justices are doing, perhaps unavoidably?
In the sense that the Illinois Supreme Court, I think, in granting the motion in this case, is saying, I know an important public issue when I see it, and we should take it because it does have an impact in the entire pension crisis system, you know, that we're facing right now, and certainly the legislature, in addressing the entire funding of pensions, needs to have the answer to the question: where does health insurance play its role in the funding formula?
Well, I know there hasn't been a pension reform plan that's come out of the General Assembly yet. There's one in the House, there's one in the Senate, and there's a conference committee that's working on something. And I think the assumption is that whatever gets passed is going straight to be appealed to the courts. Are we then saying that we expect the Illinois Supreme Court, Kirk, to restrain itself on whatever ruling they issue, so they can see what legislation is coming and maybe give a more definitive ruling on it?
Well, I think they'll give a definitive ruling, but what I'm really saying is the central point here is that this is a facial challenge to the statute. That's the hardest kind of constitutional challenge to make. And constitutional challenges on the civil side in the last 10 years of the court have fared pretty poorly in front of this court. The court will know full well if they were to say something about the pension protection clause. Say, for example, well, of course it covers health benefits. Some description of the clause that made it clear that absolutely any change in the situation for retirees was covered by the clause. Arguably, they could bring the negotiations at the legislature almost to a halt if they signaled that there was going to be no wiggle room here at all. The courts will do that sort of thing when they feel like they really have no alternative. The first case that comes to mind is the LeBron case in, I believe it was late 2010, when the court struck down tort reform. That was an instance that the court put itself in the middle of a very political, very public issue because it thought it had no alternative. But I suspect that They are going to try to find a way to resolve Kanerva that doesn't involve that kind of a dramatic decision, and just let the whole thing play out at the legislature.
And then see, and then they'll have to see what type of dramatic decision they may have to make from the legislation that gets passed, assuming that the General Assembly finally gets something passed and sent to the governor.
Oh, I think you're right. I think the chances that whenever something is passed out of the legislature, that it'll ultimately wind up at the Illinois Supreme Court are 100%.
And this is the sort of case that where the buck would stop there. This is not the sort of thing where somebody would see a clause or a in the U.S. Constitution or a federal ruling somewhere that would give the U.S. Supreme Court a voice in this question.
This is not a U.S. Supreme Court issue. This is not. This is an Illinois constitutional law issue.
So this is Illinois Supreme Court is going to be the decider on this one.
That's correct. Now, it isn't unusual for parties to try to find what they would call persuasive authority from other jurisdictions. I glanced at one of the briefs in this case and saw some case decided in New York in the 80s, and someone is saying, don't pay any attention to that case. I think it was the labor union for the state employees system was saying, don't pay any attention to this New York case. But it's Illinois cases, and I think I don't know what Kirk's feel is. These appear to be issues of first impression.
And by issues of first impression, what does that mean?
That means that there's not a lot of court cases that actually address an issue like this health insurance one, or ultimately whatever legislation gets passed by the General Assembly that would directly affect pension benefits.
For a Supreme Court justice, it sounds that a case like this either has to be very exciting or perhaps a little frightening if they're going into uncharted territories as to what the language of the Illinois Constitution means in this case.
I suspect it depends on the personality of the judge, but that's right. There is very little in this area, and Kanerva in particular has turned on a battle between a 10-year-old case from Alaska and a case from Hawaii, which the plaintiffs are relying on to argue that medical insurance is protected by a pension clause, versus the defendants are relying on a New York case which held the exact opposite. The pension protection clauses are there are several around the country, so there's a smattering of law around the country to help the court, but there's little to nothing out of Illinois.
Well, the fact that they're looking at cases in other states leads me to the question, is the language in the Illinois Constitution on contracts pretty much similar to language in other constitutions?
Well, we have a contract provision, but we also have a pension benefit provision. And so our contract provision, I think, is similar to many state constitution contract provisions. But I think Kirk has pointed out correctly that our pension benefit, there are a handful of those. And so if you stop and think historically, when Illinois became a state and had a Supreme Court and there were no existing cases, then it was not unusual to argue cases from the East, from the original colonies and the original United States, to use those principles to argue that ought to be what Illinois law is, and that was the common law. And so when you find a situation like this where you have an issue of first impression, it's not unusual to look at Alaska or Hawaii or New York if there can be an argument.
Okay. Well, it's time for a short break here on Focus, and we'll be back in a moment and looking at some of the other cases coming before the Illinois Supreme Court this fall. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about the Illinois Supreme Court, which I guess may be convening right now, apparently largely ceremonial today, but it is the second Monday of September So the state's highest court does have some business to do at their temporary quarters up in the Michael Bolandic building in Chicago. We're talking about the court and some of the cases before it with Steve Beckett here in Urbana. He's with the Urbana law firm Beckett and Weber and a lecturer in law at the University of Illinois College of Law. Former member of the Champaign County Board, he's argued a few cases before the Illinois Supreme Court, as well as argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. Also with us on the phone, Kirk Jenkins, and who is also argued cases before the Illinois Supreme Court. He's a partner with Sedgwick Law in Chicago, and he blogs for The Appellate Strategist. Kirk, I wanted to ask you about a case which at least we're calling here in shorthand the condo case, but it's the Spanish Court 2 Condominium Association versus Lisa Carlson. And I'm not quite sure if I understand it correctly. The question I have before me is, can a condo owner refuse to pay their condo upkeep fee if they feel the upkeep is poor? Is that's not correct, is it?
That's essentially correct. What happened here is, what allegedly happened here is the condo owner in this case stopped paying for, I believe, if memory serves, a little over a year, the general and special assessments. Ultimately, the condominium board sued the condo owner under something that's called the Forcible Entry and Detainer Act. And that is a special procedure in civil law. It also applies to landlords and rental situations, but it is applicable to condos. And it is a special procedure for to recover possession of the unit. The condo board in this case sued. Count one was for possession. Count two sought damages for the unpaid assessments. The tenant responded by raising defenses and a counterclaim, essentially without getting into the facts too deeply. She said that the common areas of the building, in particular the roof and the area above her unit, had not been kept up by the condo board. She said, I pay these assessments pursuant to our agreement in return for your promise to repair and maintain, and you haven't done that. Therefore, I owe you nothing. The question that was decided in Spanish Court 2 Condominium is, can she do that in this framework? It gets into some fairly technical issues that only a lawyer would love about what's germane to a Forcible Entry and Detainer Act case. But what it comes down to is, can you defend the case that way? The appellate court said, actually, yes, you can. That places Illinois in a fairly small minority around the country that allow that sort of thing as a defense. And that's why the condominium community has become very interested in this case. And I believe there have been several amicus briefs filed at the Supreme Court about it.
And to make sure I'm clear here, by saying that Lisa Carlson can refuse to pay, is that saying that Lisa Carlson does not have to take it to court, does not have to say, take the condo association to court, say, charging breach of contract by failing to provide adequate services, that she can just refuse to pay?
Well, as a practical matter, she's going to get taken to court if she refuses to pay. But in theory, could she bring a what's called a Declaratory Judgment Act to get permission not to pay? I suppose so, although this is not an area that's been explored much, because really the Spanish Court condominium case is a first for Illinois. To take the court just at what it said in the decision, they said, yes, you can simply refuse to pay, and that's a valid excuse not to pay the assessment if you believe there's been a breach of duty.
but that's rare going around the country, is what you were saying.
It may. There is a very small minority of states around the country that allow that as a defense. The primary reason is these actions, the Forcible Entry and Detainer Act actions. As I said, they're a special thing in the law. It's no big secret that most legal proceedings tend to take a while. And both in landlord situations and in condo situations, if you've gotten to the point where you're trying to recover possession of the property, you don't want it in 2 or 3 years. You want it in 3 to 6 months. So that's really what the thing turns on. Should we open these cases up to litigation about really the management in general of the development, as opposed to do you owe something and have you paid? End of story.
Okay, well, that sounds like a case that certainly the condo industry and perhaps especially some certain condo owners, if not all of them, will be wondering about to see what the ruling is there. I want to go back to the case we were talking about just a moment ago about pensions and the Kinnerva versus Weems case, because we have a call on that. Danny from Urbana on line one. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thanks. My question is it possible to get the current or potential future pension litigation in Illinois into the federal courts on the basis that Illinois enjoys an exemption from paying FICA taxes based upon this pension system, and that therefore certain standards have to be met in order to enjoy this exemption? I'm one of the people in the system, and, you know, I think we have a better chance in the federal courts that someone reads the law closely than we do in the state Supreme Court. And so I'm interested in ways of getting it into the federal courts. So is that a way to do it? Because the Illinois system was outlined, and they have an exemption from the federal government.
I would really be surprised that this issue could find its way into a federal court. It appears to me to be a unique Illinois constitutional issue, and it would have I understand, but it would have to involve some impact on the Social Security system that is happening because of the decision that is being made under Illinois law. And I'm no pension expert, but as a matter of federal civil procedure, I'm still grappling with the thought that you have that somehow I could bring a lawsuit in federal court.
Kirk, how do you see it?
I agree that, will someone try to get it into federal court? I suspect the answer is probably yes. And as far as opining whether one argument or another has more or less of a chance, I think it's going to be a very difficult road to get into to federal court. But is there a possibility that an attorney might come up with a way that that sticks? Conceivably, although I think it's absolutely right, it's going to be an uphill battle. But the threat that that would be involved in a claim like that is, to the extent that it the case still revolves around the Pension Protection Clause and the Illinois Contract Impairment Clause. Going to federal court is not necessarily going to change the outcome. The federal courts on these issues that are prototypically Illinois, the federal courts are not supposed to be deciding them on their own. For example, if a federal district court was asked to interpret the Pension Protection Clause, the issue is supposed to be, what would the Illinois Supreme Court do, as opposed to what does that court think on its own about the issue?
Okay, I'm going to take another call. This is from line two on the pension question. This is Tony from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, I have a quick question probably, and that is that I don't hear anybody talking about the fact that you can't, I mean, the pension that was negotiated, the amounts and everything, even if you disregard the, if you don't talk about the health care and just talk about that, the amount that was settled on was heavily dependent on whether or not health care would be there or not. So I don't see how I don't hear anybody addressing that the way they're connected. And there's got to be some way that the court can say, well, because this depended so much on that, you can't really separate the two. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Tony. And is that can that argument be made, and would the court hear it? That the pension and the health care payments are linked.
In fact, it is one of the arguments that's being made before the Supreme Court. The parties that are defending the retirees' position have aggressively argued that number one, this is a pension, and number two, the circuit court argued that these are two very separated things. They said the health benefits are paid from a different fund, they're set in a different way, et cetera, et cetera. And the attorneys representing the retirees have argued, actually, that's a false dichotomy. It's not nearly as independent as the circuit court has made it out to be. So I suspect the Supreme Court will probably be opining one way or the other on exactly the issue that the caller is raising.
Well, as Steve and I were talking about before the broadcast, the pension question itself could certainly be a whole hour of focus and then some. But I'm going to go over to another case coming before the Supreme Court this fall in the time we have left. And this is another criminal case, Steve. The People versus Budimir Radijic. Thank you very much, Steve. And this involves attorney-client privilege relationships.
It does. Radijic, as a defendant, is accused of conspiring with others to commit a massive real estate fraud. He was converting apartments into condos, creating straw purchasers, and giving false information to apply for loans. And so it's a complex scheme. And he was using an attorney to help him with his various real estate transactions. And that attorney was actually indicted with him. But the prosecution listed the attorney as a witness that the prosecution was going to call to testify against Radijic. And, of course, the defendant then filed a motion that said, wait a minute, you can't call my attorney. I have attorney-client privilege. There's an exception to the attorney-client privilege called crime fraud, that you cannot use your relationship and the communications that you have with your attorney to advance the fraud. The trial court, without having what we call an in-camera hearing, ruled that the attorney's name should be struck from the witness list because it would invade attorney-client privilege. The appellate court, First District Appellate Court, reversed, not only saying not addressing the procedural issue about whether there would be an in-camera ex parte hearing to find out what the communications actually were between the client and the attorney, basically said by looking at other evidence, we think that it's been waived. That's in conflict, and that procedure is in conflict with another appellate decision, I think, from the same district. This is another illustration of how the Supreme Court might take a case to clarify an important issue.
And the importance of this issue, that this really could affect attorney-client relationships in cases to come of all sorts.
Sure. I think criminal cases involving real estate transactions where there ultimately is some claim of fraud, if you were an attorney who were doing real estate transactions, that's pretty disconcerting to think that conversations that you're having are confidential and all of a sudden now you're a witness against your client in a criminal case.
We have just 1 minute left, and Kirk, I did want to touch on one other case because I think there's more than one example of it, and that's Hartney Fuel Oil Company versus the board of the Village of Forest View, which seems to be the matter of a company in one jurisdiction setting up an office in another jurisdiction where the taxes are lower in order to claim the lower tax rates in that other county or community. And what are the implications of a ruling here?
The tax involved is actually the sales tax rather than the business taxes or income taxes or anything like that. And the implication is going to be how much, if you're going to do something like this, and it's perfectly legal, and no one's suggesting it's not, but if you're going to do something like this, how much of your business do you have to move into the jurisdiction? It seems fairly clear if you read the appellate opinion that the sales operation actually was in Putnam County. But other parts of the business were in Cook County. So that's what it turns on, whether enough of the business was moved so that the sales tax, whether the sales were occurring in the low tax county or the higher tax county.
Well, I had seen at least one other case of this in which a company opened up an office, and I gather not much of an office, in Kankakee, in order to take advantage of lower taxes there. But this will pretty much raise the question of how much of an office you have to do the stateside version of incorporating in Delaware.
That's exactly right. Obviously, it's more expensive and more of a dislocation to essentially move your entire business center of gravity to another county, as opposed to simply opening a very small office to deal just with sales. And if they were to adopt some sort of a totality of the circumstances or a center of gravity test, then it would become less commonplace for these kinds of moves to be made to the lower tax counties.
Well, that's all the time we have now to talk about cases coming before the Illinois Supreme Court in the fall term. My thanks to Kirk Jenkins of Sedgwick Law in Chicago and Steve Beckett of Beckett and Weber in Urbana. This is Focus on WILL.